ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Just 40 years ago, racism was legal in South Africa.
You were a non-person. You were non-white.
I'm Sisonke Msimang. My dad was a freedom fighter against apartheid, and I grew up as part of a global movement to end that injustice. But I don't know much about what Australians did. So join me as I meet the Aussies who took a stand and helped change world history. ABC Rewind Boycott. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, hello, Meredith Lake here. Great to be with you for Soul Search. If I asked you what you value most in your life, I bet you wouldn't say money and the accumulation of wealth. A lot of us would say our family and our friends. It's our relationships that really matter, and a lot of us want a less cluttered life. But how far would you actually go to escape the rat race of getting and spending and to prioritise those non-material things in your life? Would you cut up your credit card and close your bank account?
I had never considered that that was a thing. Like, really? People could choose to live without money? It was mind-blowing. Once I had my answer and realised that I could get out, this sense of excitement built and grew, and I was like, oh my goodness. It was mixed with like trepidation and a little bit of fear around some things, but mostly it was excitement, like, oh my goodness, this is so amazing. This is what I'm going to do. It's like my actions and my values aligned.
Joe Nemeth has lived without money for at least 10 years now. Not earning it, not spending it. She doesn't even have a bank account. Wow. So why has she chosen this? And how does she make it work in her day-to-day life? What does this radical refusal of money mean for where she finds meaning and joy? Jo, hello. Thanks for being with me for Soul Search.
Hi, Meredith. Thank you very much for talking to me.
I think a lot of us struggle to imagine life without money. So I wonder if we could actually just kind of get a little bit of a glimpse of how you make it work in terms of what have you eaten already today and where did that come from if you didn't buy it at the supermarket?
Well, I live in a moneyed household at the moment. So in the I've been living without money for 10 and a half years or so. And so in that time I've lived without money in different situations in different ways. Currently I'm living in a household with other people. I wasn't before. And now that I'm in this regular suburban household, I sometimes consume the food that they have bought. But the idea of me being in this household is that I reduce the consumption of resources in the household as a whole. Mm-hmm. So I'm like this household manager / homesteader / wife. You know, there's many different labels. Mm-hmm. And so my role is to be at home and do all the things that I enjoy doing, which is a lot of cooking and cleaning and preserving and growing and all of that kind of thing. And that helps to reduce the overall consumption of the household for the needs for food, the needs for energy, the needs for water, all of those sorts of things. So that's, yeah, my contribution isn't financial, but I contribute in other ways.
Hmm. Sounds like you have a garden.
We do have a garden, yes. And I'm also heavily involved in the local community garden, which I kind of feel like is a bit of an extension of our home garden. We've got cauliflowers and cabbages, you know, we've got carrots, we've got yeah, and we've got a whole plethora of subtropical stuff that most people from my background wouldn't recognise as food. But we're okay. Expanding our repertoire so that mm-hmm. we can be more climate resilient.
Hmm. In terms of what you wear, how does that work without money?
Well, I think most of your listeners will know that we have way too many clothes in our middle-class Australia. We're overloaded, overwhelmed. I even have clothes that I have to give away because I have too many clothes. I still have some clothes that I had from when I had money. But since in the last 10 years, I've been able to gather clothes from all over the place. The latest bit of clothing is a shirt that I'm wearing right now that was given to me by a neighbour who saw it somewhere and thought, oh, that'd be a great gardening shirt for Jo. I wonder if she'll want that. So she just gave it to me. So I'm just going to introduce this concept of the gift economy. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have already heard of that. But before, when I was living with money, I was kind of dabbling in the gift economy, like with friends and family. I'd give them things, they'd give me things, and that's how it works. But now my 100% of my life is lived in this gift economy and gift culture, where I use my time and my skills, you know, all these other things other than money, to gift to other people in different ways, and other people gift to me, not reciprocal necessarily, but like my neighbour giving me a shirt just randomly. I didn't give her anything in exchange, but that's that gift culture that we all know and we're all part of. But for me, that's 100% of my life.
Hmm. The third piece of the puzzle in terms of painting that kind of initial picture is, you mentioned energy consumption as well, Jo, and yep. For a lot of us that comes up in the ways that we travel. So how did you get to the studio? How do you move around without money?
So transport for me is mostly on foot or by bike. Sometimes I use a car if I can justify it. So, for example, my household is part of a waste food pickup team that we pick up waste food from a local supermarket, and that goes to a local animal sanctuary. So for that, I have to borrow one of the cars from one of the other household members. But mostly, so today I got here with half on bike, half on foot. It's very uphill here, so I had to walk the last bit on foot.
Sure.
Yeah. But as you know, energy at home, though, like because I'm at home and there's solar on the roof, it's really useful to have someone who can be there during the day to use that power as it comes through the house and back into the grid. So, yeah, so it's great that I can keep the energy consumption down by being at home and doing that.
Jo, it sounds like living without money has reframed your relationships, the rhythm of your day, of your week, perhaps even of your year.
Yep.
And I'd love to understand, what was it that moved you in this direction? If you could take me back those 10 and a half years, why did you decide to seek a life that doesn't revolve around the gaining and spending of money?
Well, back, I was working, living a regular life before I decided to do this, and I had a great job. I was a community development worker at a local neighbourhood centre and, you know, managing the local community garden. It was a job that was made for me. It was perfect for me. However, I was still stressed, and I get stressed quite easily, and I thought, well, this isn't great. But that wasn't the main reason. The main reason was that I was, you know, I was working 20 hours a week, which is good. It's kind of part-time. And then I had this time at home where I was researching and I was reading and I was looking into supply lines of different products. I was looking at, you know, what meat is best for us to eat, and every kind of meat that I was looking at was bad and was hurting ecosystems, and not only animals but the ecosystems from, you know, from where they come, like the oceans. And, you know, the more I delved into where the products that we were consuming were coming from, the worse I felt. I just started to feel really sad. I started to feel very guilty, and I was connecting my consumption with pain and suffering globally, because that is the nature of our industrial globalized system. The economic system is that we do, that even the simplest things that we buy have these massive supply lines that are hooked in all over the world and are doing untold damage. And we don't normally stop to think about that. And I was stopping and I was thinking about it, and it was really not good for my mental health. And I didn't know what to do about it. Like, I was at the supermarket, and more it would take me forever to decide which was the best of the bad products, you know, even tomatoes, canned tomatoes, you know, like, certainly I've got to buy something from Australia, but then are the farmers being undercut here? You know, who's being hurt by this product?
You know, I've had this exact conversation in the aisle of the supermarket with a friend, like, should I buy,
you know,
the things that are grown in a certain way, or things that have come from a certain place, and how do you evaluate this or that?
And there's so much to consider. And so that was really doing my head in. And then I was in bed on my birthday in 2014, and my parents had given me this book for my birthday called Changing Gears, written by Greg Forster. Forster. So Greg and his partner rode their bikes up and down the east coast of Australia, and they were visiting people who were living simply. And in that book, I haven't read it since then, so I should go back and read it because I have to clarify this for people. I don't actually remember, but I think somewhere in that book they mentioned somebody who had chosen to live without money. And as soon as I read that, that was my answer, and I could not put that idea down. It was, I was...
What was it that grabbed you?
I guess I had never considered that that was a thing. Like, really? People could choose to live without money? It was mind-blowing. It grabbed me because it was a solution to my problems. You know, I could get out of all of this and I could stop hurting myself and others. So it was such a revelation. And then it just became like this calling. Like, I couldn't put it down. It was just, I was totally driven by it. So that was it for me. I spent the next year planning, and then I started living without money in April 2015.
Wow. Joe, I speak to quite a few people from time to time who are seeking a simpler life, who register what you're describing, that sense of stress and overwhelm and even a kind of grief or guilt around, I guess, the complicity we all have in the systems that structure our society, right?
Yes.
And yet there's lots of ways that that can be expressed, but I'm fascinated about why money became or is for you the thing that you had to refuse in order to make the change that you were seeking.
Well, I guess I was trying other things. You know, I was trying to grow food at home, and I was trying to minimise my impacts by buying the best product or whatever, but it was still only scraping the surface. Like, none of that really got to the core of the issue for me. But, you know, having said that, I'm totally in awe of people that I know who can minimise their impacts, who live really simply, who live really lovingly on the planet whilst still using money. I think that's amazing. But I knew that I couldn't do it. I know myself, and I know that if I even have a little bit of money, it's going to be really hard not to just buy some sort of crap that is going to be not good. So, you know, even without money, I have to be conscious of it sometimes. People have offered me cars, for instance, you know, like, oh, I've got this old car, do you want it? Like, you know, so there's just, I could still be engaging much more with the system than I am, but I'm really conscious and careful not to. But having no money makes it much easier. It really does. I mean, I talked to my friend Sharon, who I live with, about this a bit, and she has money and she's got a great career and is fully dedicated to helping people through the career choice that she's made. But, you know, it's difficult. She says, I struggle, Jo, because I have money and it's too easy just to do the thing or buy the thing, you know. It's such a struggle. I said, yeah, I know, Sharon, that's how I used to feel. And I'm really lucky that I don't feel that way anymore. I just don't have the option, so it's easy.
So in a way, it's about creating the space where you can make a different choice. It's about putting in a boundary. Is that it's kind of how it sounds to me?
It's a hard line. I just don't have the option anymore to do the damage that I used to do.
You said something there about living simply and lovingly.
Yes.
I wonder if you could just elaborate on how those things sing together.
Well, you know, I think that the pain that I was feeling before I gave up money, and the pain that, you know, many of your listeners will recognise, that grief is about, it's coming from a sense, a place of love, I believe. For me, it certainly was and it still is. I feel this care and love for the biosphere, for not only the environment and the creatures around me and across the world, but people who are, you know, my brothers and sisters, my global brothers and sisters. I haven't met many of them. I have travelled a bit in my earlier life. I travelled a bit, so I've seen like extreme poverty in other places in the world, and I know that our system, the way that it is violent. Inherently, it's violent. It creates this, like our you know, buying things in Australia here creates so much damage and collateral damage to people's lives and to ecosystems. So I think to choose to live lovingly for me is about trying to minimise my engagement in that system of violence. I want to not do that harm. I want to minimise that suffering that I have been involved in. And, you know, and I think that that sense of sadness and grief that we feel is coming from a place of wanting to be more loving.
How did you process that grief? Was there an element of lament in this? Or I'm just so curious about how your, I guess, what you might call your mental health or your emotional response to all of this played out.
I think it was like I was feeling very down before I realised that I could live without money. But once I realised that I could, everything really changed virtually overnight.
Really?
Totally. Once I had my answer and realised that I could get out, that there was a back door, then I just started planning and I just started, this sense of excitement built and grew, and I was like, oh my goodness, it was mixed with like trepidation and a little bit of fear around some things, but mostly it was excitement, like, oh my goodness, this is so amazing, this is what I'm going to do, it's going to be so much fun. So I've kind of felt like that since underneath it all, but you know, just it's like my actions and my values aligned. And, you know, I think that part of that sadness and grief is about our actions and values not aligning as well. And so when I was able to align the two, it was such a sense of relief as well. It's like, oh, this feels amazing. You know, I don't have that kind of grating sense that things just aren't right anymore. I really feel right. I feel clear. I feel driven and dedicated.
Sounds like there's a kind of freedom in it for you.
Definitely. Freedom is the perfect word.
This is Soul Search by podcast and on ABC Radio National. I'm Meredith Lake and I'm talking with Jo Nemeth. She's been living without money for upwards of 10 years now. We live in a culture that is so clearly oriented around production and consumption. And yet many societies, including our own, I think, have perhaps older notions of certainly of exchange, but also of gift. And I wonder if you could just elaborate on what you mean by the gift economy and what that looks like for you.
Well, it's such a big subject. Look, the gift economy allows me and other people to live more connected with others. It's I think our monetary economy is disconnecting. And if you can buy something over the counter here that's come from the other side of the world, you're never going to know what those people's lives are who have made that product, you know. Whereas, you know, if you're in a gift exchange with someone, gift economy, then you're kind of face-to-face and it's building a camaraderie, like, oh, I can do this thing for you, or I've got this thing I can give to you. And it builds connection. It really does build connection. And I think that that's one of the big things that we're suffering from in our world is that lack of connection. People are looking for connection. I think gifting and being more involved in this gift culture, this ancient method of exchange, is one of the ways that we can be more connected with others. And I get a real kick out of it. You know, living my life like that now is fantastic, and I definitely feel like I have a lot more social currency, like I've got a lot more connections, closer connections with people now. A lot of people in my hemisphere here in Lismore know now, oh, I've got this old bag of oats in the cupboard here. I don't want to chuck it in the bin. I'm going to see if Joe wants it. So it has created this thing now. So I can supply my household with food that's often waste food from other people in that way. Yeah,
it's not a transaction. Yeah. You're using the language of exchange, but it's not barter, is it?
No, it is not transaction. And I wanted to be really careful when I started living like this to not be engaging in barter or that kind of transaction. I'll give you this and then you give me that, which is of equal value. Like that's kind of missing the point. It doesn't feel the same as just gifting. Gifting is more like pay it forward. You know, I've got this thing here, you have it, and you don't have to give me anything in return. And then, you know, at some point you'll give something to someone else.
One of the questions I have around this, though, is it seems to me to assume abundance rather than scarcity, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I wonder how you reflect on, or for you, why is it possible actually to be generous without expectation? Because that's kind of what it seems to me that pay it forward requires.
Mm. That's interesting.
And yet it runs so counter to the scarcity model.
Yeah.
That I think our systems are
built
reproduce.
On
yeah. They're yeah. The, that's the narrative anyway.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, built on this scarcity framework. Look, I think it started with having more time. You know, I moved on to a friend's farm just outside of Lismore when I first started living without money, and I was there for the first year and a half, and I had lots of time. I was growing food and helping out around the farm or helping out with the kids there, but I had a lot of time, and that was new and different, and I actually felt a bit guilty because everyone around me was continuing on with their busy, hectic lives. And I just felt like I was on a permanent holiday. But I think because I had time, then I was able to give my time. And that's a luxury that a lot of us don't have, right? Mm. So, or wish we had more of.
Yeah.
So I just started I was able to go and help this friend here and help another friend there and do a bit of gardening here or, you know, that's sort of simple stuff. But that's really that was the beginning of it. That was kind of the crux of it. And from there, I guess, you know, moving around to different places since then, I've just, you know, been able to give of myself in other ways, but not necessarily giving things. And that's the difference, I think. So, you know, even being able to listen to someone, you know, when I hitchhike, I feel like hitching is this amazing opportunity to give of myself in that I sit in a car and often I listen, just listening to someone's story or someone's issues that they had that morning or, you know, wherever that person is at. And I only hitch short distances, about 15, 20 minutes, and I get this snapshot. And, you know, I've gotten out of the car at times and people said, oh, thank you, I really just needed to get that off my chest. So, you know, gifting can be all sorts of things. We don't need to think of it necessarily as just these physical, tangible things.
But that involves revaluing, actually.
Yes. Yes.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, it's seeing the world differently. I do see the world differently because I don't have that kind of money thing going on. And, you know, the exchanges, you know, these moments that I share with people are many and varied, and like everything in my life is that, right? So I value it and I think about it a lot and I feel really, really good most of the time because of these moments. It's connecting, it's loving. And it's how we used to live, you know, when a lot of people, some people in the world still do.
So what about when it doesn't feel good or when it's been really difficult? There must have been times where, you know, the mental shift hasn't been complete and you found yourself in a situation where it's kind of grated, or maybe I wonder if there have been times when you've regretted, you know, finding yourself in whatever situation you might be in at that point. How do you navigate those? What's that been like for you?
There haven't been many times like that. Most of the time, if I get into a sticky situation, I feel more of excitement, I guess, about, oh, how am I going to solve this issue without money? I kind of like that kind of little bit of pressure, not too much, but that's happened a few times. But, you know, recently I've had issues. So I have a bike, a push bike, that my parents bought for me as a present, a birthday present, I think, a couple of years ago. And it's this fantastic bike. I really like it. So easy to ride. But I've discovered that, you know, having a bike requires money. It's very difficult. So with a bike.
You need a new tyre or a service.
Yeah, the ongoing maintenance of a bike has been an issue for me. My bike has been maintained by other people and paid. The parts have been paid for by other people. And that is kind of the one place in my money-free life that I felt uncomfortable recently. And I'm like, I don't actually think I can maintain this. I don't think having a bike and not having money is not really working for me. But then But really what that's about for me is about my feeling uncomfortable about someone paying money for something for me. Because
so
I don't...
you had to learn how to receive gifts as
exactly.
part of this.
Exactly. That is really important, Meredith. And I think that that's been a big thing for me, and it's a big thing for other people that I watch around me, especially when, you know, sometimes when I give something to someone, they're like, oh, I have to give you something in return. You know, it's this, we are taught that we can't just receive, that we have to give something in return. And... you know, I had a conversation with a friend. I said, look, just pay it forward. Remember that I trust that you will pay it forward. You're going to do good things for other people because you're that kind of person. So just accept it and receive it, you know. But then it's hard for me to sometimes do that myself.
Why is it hard for us, do you think? I think about this actually. Like, what is it? We're taught to be independent, self-reliant, autonomous individuals, and
yes.
we all learned during COVID what an absolute myth that was, and yet
exactly.
we don't quite shake it off.
Yeah.
But yep. why is it so hard to shake off, and how have you, I guess, tried to, lessen the pull of that, I guess, in your own life?
That's our culture. Our culture is, you know, it's everything. It's so we're living and breathing it since, you know, from the day we're born. We're taught that we have to be strong, resilient, independent individuals, and that is a lie, and we can never be that, and we're not meant to be that. But that serves, you know, for want of a better word, that serves the capitalist system that we live under, and it's so damaging. It's such a terrible way to live, and it's doing untold damage not only to other people and around the world and the planet, but to our own mental health and well-being. It's not how humans evolved to live. We're meant to be living with others. We're meant to be reliant on others. We are reliant on others all the time. Even with money, we are completely reliant on other people making the things and doing the things, and then we just pass over a bit of money and we get the result. But it's not, we're not self-reliant, and we're not independent, and we're not individuals. We are part of a group, and we're meant to be that way. So, you know, when people hear that I live without money, one of the main criticisms is that, oh, you're just bludging off other people, you're just using other people. My response to that is that, well, none of us are independent really. We're just not really conscious of the dependence that we have on other people.
I'm so struck by the extent to which you've been able to put this into practice in your own life, Jo. Mm. And I guess that makes me curious about how that might be possible, and especially about what anchors these convictions for you. Was there, you've mentioned your parents a couple of times, the book they lent you, the bike that they gave you.
Yeah.
Were you raised with these kinds of sensitivities or perspectives, or did you have a vocabulary for them? Like, how do you account for the particular moral imagination that you have?
I've thought about it quite a bit. I'm not really sure. Well, sometimes I just wonder, why am I like this, and why is it that, you know, most people around me don't seem to be on the same wavelength, and I don't understand. And I don't know. I really don't know the answer. It's just that I kind of see the world through these different glasses, and in my childhood, I was taught some really valuable lessons. I'm nervous about saying it, but I was raised a Catholic, and usually people have some joke that goes along with that. But no, I was raised a Catholic, and one of the main things that I took away from that was that it's the importance of loving others as you would like to be loved, or caring for others the way that you want to be treated. And that's something that I think drives me deep down. And then my parents my parents are kind, caring, loving people, especially, so my mum is especially frugal, so I learnt to be frugal. I learnt the value of frugality. I learnt the value of simplicity. My dad taught me to use what I have available to me and not just go and buy something. So they are really valuable lessons that I learnt growing up. And I also was taught to be tough, you know, and to face my fears and just get on with it and do stuff. So, you know, those sorts of lessons from my early childhood have served me well. I think that Catholic kind of message of, loving others is that's really at the crux of it, whether or not that has come from there or where it's come from, but that's at the crux of what I, why I do what I do. It's about being loving, of caring towards others, you know. And I'm not really great at being loving and caring towards those who I'm kind of living with. My household members might find me trying at times. I guess my, you know, my loving feelings extend kind of broader. It's more of a humanity level feeling of love.
Well, that's a dance we're all doing, isn't it? How do you love in the immediate ways inside our own domestic arrangements and on that wider, well, even beyond our own species perhaps? I mean, you said that that principle of loving as you'd like to be loved is something you took, which it makes me wonder if you left a lot of other things behind from your Catholic upbringing. Is there any religious or spiritual vocabulary or source that you find enlivening or helpful in some way at all now? Is that, I mean, 'cause for some people, that is absolutely a source for resisting the system as we find it. Mm. And yet it's not always. And I'm just curious about how you now sustain a very radical path of resistance.
Yeah, I think, well, so from that experience with Catholicism as a child, I guess I didn't really, there was a long gap then before I became a hippie, and I was a hippie for a while. I still am, I guess, in deep down inside. I've had some really very deep and profound spiritual, inverted commas, experiences in my adult life.
Really?
And in those, you know, and this is without taking any drugs, mind you, but in those experiences, I have felt a deep, deep connection to my environment, to the place where I am at that point in time. In fact, one of the most blissful and deeply spiritual experiences was actually in the middle of Osaka in Japan. So
really?
that was a strange one.
What happened?
I read this book. I was reading this novel by Tom Robbins called Skinny Legs and All. And the last chapter I was on my way, just about to go to work in an English school, and I was sitting in a cafe and I just read the last chapter, and his words in that book were just blew me away and had this incredibly profound effect on me. And I kind of just somehow I was suddenly just in this altered state. I can't describe it, but I was felt like I was walking on air, walking on clouds, you know, that feeling. And I walked from that cafe to work through the underground kind of tunnels where everybody walks. Just the whole way I felt like I was walking on air. It was so weird and beautiful and amazing. And so that was just through the power of words, through these ideas and concepts that he elaborated on in the end of this book. But, you know, other experiences have just been lying on the grass in the sun, you know, and listening to the birds, and, you know, being a child outside in the moonlight listening to the willy wagtails on the cattle farm where I grew up. You know, those sorts of experiences have just led me to have just increased my feelings of connection with the world around me and others.
It's interesting that reading has been important to some of the most transformative moments in Jo Nemeth's life, at times intertwined with her spirituality and part of her decision to live without money or even a bank account. In a moment, you're going to hear more about books and reading because it connects with this idea of the gift economy. You know those little street libraries that have cropped up all over the place? They're an example of paying it forward, of a different kind of economy. Right now, though, I'm talking with Jo for Soul Search on Radio National. She's leaned right into the gift economy. So what's she expecting in the next decade of her moneyless life? Jo, I think for a lot of us, our anxieties around the future might be to do with our health, what older age might involve, to the extent that people are able to save money or store up money, that's often how we rationalise that to ourselves. It's about making provision for our, you know, more frail futures.
Yep.
And so when you look forward, how do you imagine a moneyless life in that season?
Well, that's a great question. I think there's a couple of things that I'd like to say about that. Firstly, I was trained as a herbalist years ago in a previous life, and so I have done some training in nutrition and I know how to use herbs, and I have a garden thanks to Sharon. And so I grow a lot of herbs at home and I use those, and I eat as well as I, well, I try to eat well, so that I can keep myself healthy for as long as I can. And I'm physically active because of the work that I do. But the other thing is that my concerns about the future aren't based on my financial stability or security. My concerns about the future are based on the collapse of civilization, which is much bigger and much more important. And I think because, you know, I don't know how many of your listeners will have heard of the concept of collapse, or if that will be quite shocking to some people, but there is a growing cohort of collapsologists or collapsniks around the world, especially in Europe, where it's, you know, it's a big thing for a lot of people. They are facing, you know, potential nuclear threat, as we all are, I suppose. But there are a number of systems in our connected globalized world that are dangerously close to collapse, whether that be financial, whether that be nuclear, whether that be ecological, whether that be, you know, even our food systems and the food that we rely on so greatly, like grains, you know, fertilizers for grains. There's so many things when you start to look deeply that are teetering on the edge of collapse. So something's going to give, and there's a lot of very prominent, well, learned people who know this and who talk about this. This is not something that I'm just coming up with. Scientists and academics. So, you know, collapse is, you know, potentially a thing, and that's something that really drives me now. When I first started living without money, I didn't know this was a thing. But I guess because I've learnt more, I've had time to read and educate myself more over the last 10 years now, I would call myself collapse aware. I'm collapse aware is the terminology that's used. So I guess, you know, my concern about the future is, you know, how is my community going to fare? What can I do to help my community to ride out this really, really rough future that we're facing? And, you know, that means growing food. So I'm really dedicated to being at home and the community garden, experimenting with more climate appropriate foods that don't need any kind of external inputs, that don't need fossil fuels or fossil fuel related fertilizers to be able to grow them. And they will grow year round and they will go through droughts and floods. You know, those sorts of foods, they're the sorts of things that I'm keen to grow more of and to help my community to grow more of. So, yeah,
I mean, it's interesting that you're using the language of community, because for some of us, and I think this is probably quite common and understandable, concerns about the future, whether it's on the level of a societal collapse or an ecological collapse or otherwise, can lead to an instinct to kind of self-preservation. You know, we've all seen those shows about people who kind of bunker down and stockpile their, you know, there's that kind of survivalism. But you're describing a very different kind of survivalism it sounds much more communal.
Yeah.
And yet self-preservation might not be on that individual level high on the list, which is kind of extraordinary.
Look, yeah, I mean, for anybody who's serious about this kind of stuff, just taking care of yourself is completely futile. It's never going to work for anyone. It kind of gets back to that cultural paradigm again, doesn't it? Like if you live in this world where it's all about the individual and taking care of yourself, then sure, I guess that's where you'd go. But that is, it's false. It's a false narrative. And really, we're part of communities, whether we like it or not. And the only way we're going to, you know, get through tumultuous times is as part of a community. And in Lismore is a great example of that, because we went through the horrible floods in 2022, and the thing that helped people get through was community. It's not about, you know, make sure I have all of the things that I need. It's about, you know, am I going to get help from my friends, my family, and how can I help other people? And so that, you know, we all around the world, there are so many kind of natural disasters and all sorts of disasters and COVID and all sorts of things happening all the time. And the thing that gets people through, if they get through, is other people and community. And so if we don't build and strengthen our communities now, I think that that's going to make life a lot more difficult in the future.
Just finally then, Jo, I wonder what has surprised you most? And I mean, in terms of the joy that it's brought you in the last decade as you've lived this moneyless life that you weren't expecting. Yeah.
I think that one of the best things that I've loved about living this way is that, you know, I guess I've had a pretty privileged and reasonably happy life up until I started living without money. So I kind of always thought the best of people, and I always felt that people were good. Inherently, people are good. And I hadn't had many bad experiences. Living without money has just really brought that home. People really are good. I've just had so many amazing experiences with people that I probably wouldn't have had otherwise, even though my experiences before weren't negative. It's just like I've had living without money just opens up this opportunity for, you know, interacting with people in a different way. And, you know, the things that people have, you know, said to me, given me, offered me, wanted, that people want to help. They want to, you know, they just, I don't know, people just have surprised me again and again with their desire to be helpful and kind and loving. And it's a beautiful thing to experience. That's probably one of the best things that I've experienced living without money for the last 10 years.
We hear so little about that deep generosity that I think you're right, runs as a seam right through our own hearts and through our communities.
Yes, yes, it does. It's a beautiful thing.
Jo, thank you for sharing the beauty of that with me.
Thank you.
Jo Nemeth, who's been living a low-impact life without money since April 2015. Jo's based in Lismore in northern New South Wales, and you can read more about her by following the links that you'll find on the Soul Search website. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what you're hearing so far, or I'd love to hear from you if you just want to say hello. You can write to me at soul.search@abc.net.au. Anytime, I'd love to hear from you. I'm Meredith Lake, with you for Soul Search by podcast and on ABC Radio National. And talking with Jo has definitely got me thinking about, well, about how I use money. What might it look like to take a step away from the cycle of spending and getting and saving and spending towards a gift economy? Maybe part of the answer is right under our noses, scattered throughout our neighbourhoods. Could the gift economy involve a colourful box full of books that people can take and return as they want? Mel Lake is the General Manager of Street Library Australia. Hello, Mel.
Hey, Meredith.
These street libraries have cropped up all over the place over the last, I reckon, 10 or maybe 15 years. But do you have a ballpark idea of how many there are in Australia these days?
Yeah, we do. So Street Library Australia has existed for almost 10 years. And in that time, we have registered just over 6,000 street libraries.
Wow.
Yeah. So that does not account for unregistered street libraries, of which there are many, many more. And I can't, you know, I can have some rough guesses. I would say maybe there's, you know, that amount again. So probably looking somewhere between 10 and 14,000 street libraries around the country.
Mel, I'm so curious about the ideas and the impulses behind a movement like this. What would you say this is really about? Like, what's the goal of the street library movement, its underlying purposes?
Our two primary motivators are promoting literacy and also connecting community. So, you know, that's interpreted in so many different ways by the people who have street libraries, and we call them street librarians. But I do think that that's the common thread that really drives the movement. And then there's a lot of lovely consequences that come from that as well. So there's, you know, a sustainability aspect to it. So keep things in circulation. And I guess that relates, you know, to the gift economy.
I'm curious about how you see the relationship of these, well, now many thousands of street libraries to, I guess the institution of the public library, Mel, because in a way, a lot of communities, a lot of neighbourhoods already have, you know, a place where you can borrow books for no charge, staffed by professional librarians, all those kinds of things. How do you see the relationship of the street library to the public library that perhaps our council might run?
Oh, I think they coexist beautifully. You know, there's a lot of differences between a street library and a public library. A street library is, you know, sometimes they are curated, but they're tiny, so they might hold 30 books. And, you know, that's not a collection. It's not a large collection like a traditional library would hold. They're generally not catalogued by their street librarians. They're generally available and open 24/7, unlike a traditional library. So, you know, I think that's probably the biggest benefit and difference of street libraries is that they're accessible ideally all the time, whereas there's, you know, a level of bureaucracy that surrounds traditional libraries, and that is also part of what makes them so great because they are funded, they have staff who are experts in what they do, they look after and track collections and gather information and assist the community, whereas a street library, you know, people might have a chat, but it's not necessarily where you go to do research, for example.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, so you can use a street library and you can not have a fixed address. And they're available and there's no strings attached, and that's a big part of what street libraries are about as well.
Wow. I'm really interested in the kind of the economic side of this, as I was saying, Mel, and I wonder if you could talk to me a little bit more about that. I mean, the idea, isn't it, is that anyone can take a book, leave a book, return a book. It doesn't even have to be the same book.
Yep.
What kind of economy do you see street libraries representing?
I see it as a sharing economy, which I know is another way of describing the gift economy. But yeah, I think it kind of challenges those traditional notions of ownership. And books are so funny, right, because we buy them. People buy them a lot of the time. And if you like them, you tend to keep them, but you may not read them again. So it's kind of wild to, you know, consider the notion of making it available to someone else. And it's something that I still struggle with as well. If it's a book that I really, really, really like, I hold on to it. But, you know, other times, if it's something that I maybe don't quite enjoy as much as, you know, something else, then I'll put it in the street library. Also, pretty much any book that I get from a street library myself, I will put back into my street library or another street library. And that's kind of weird because I feel like I don't own it because it's come, you know, it's come to me by chance. I haven't sorted out. I've just chanced upon this book and I feel like it's not mine. So I guess it's that kind of notion that really, you know, taps into the sharing and the gift economy. But people are very, very generous. Like there's a lot of street librarians out there and they'll go and, you know, visit their local op shops, for example, and they'll get collections of books that they kind of stock up their street libraries with. Other people just really rely on the community to keep the library looking fresh. I've never bought a book specifically for my street library. I rely on my community and I do kind of circulate the books through there because we do find that a street library that looks like it's being monitored and cleaned and, you know, refreshed a little tends to do better.
In a way, these are sustained, at least in some cases, by the repeated gifts of,
yes,
say, the street librarian who keeps donating their own books or books that they've paid for somewhere else into that street library.
Yep.
But it's interesting what you were saying about how if you take a book from the street library, you're pretty much going to return it there because it feels like something that belongs to everyone, not just to you. Like
that's
there's
right.
an idea of reciprocity that's fostered just by having the book in a street library.
That's right. And we do say, like one of our mottos is take a book, give a book, share a book. But yeah, I think that the motivations are really, they're probably not that different for a lot of street librarians. I think that people want to keep books in circulation, make sure that they're being enjoyed and used, and also that they really want to encourage people to read because, you know, there's a lot of research that suggests that people are reading less these days and, you know, there's a lot less reading of actual books. A lot of people really hold the notion of reading a book so dear and they want to share that with other people. And a street library is a really, really simple way of being able to encourage other people to talk about and read books and talk to each other, which, you know, feeds into the community.
One of the questions I have around street libraries is what does this mean for the authors of the books that might go through there? Because as you know, if a book, say, is borrowed from one of those organised council-run libraries, the author of the book will get like a lending right. There'll be a small payment that eventually ends up with the author. Whereas this system, I wonder what it means for authors and who's included, I guess, in this sharing economy or perhaps left out of it. How do you reflect on that difference, I guess, between the street library with no royalties and the public library, which does pay royalties?
Yeah, look, I can only really speak to that anecdotally because I wonder about it as well and how it makes an author feel to see one of their books in a street library. But generally speaking, I think that it makes them happy because we have a lot of authors within the street library community and they see it as, I guess, just an avenue of being able to spread the word about their books and to, you know, again, encourage reading. And all in all, I think that, authors generally see it as a positive thing because it just means the book's been read and then it's going to get passed on to someone else. So it's out there potentially alerting someone to an author's work and then perhaps they'll go out and buy their next published work. So I have to try not to think about it too much, Meredith, because, it's something that...
Yeah, it's complex, isn't
it? Yeah, it's complex. I've never had an author get cross at us about what we're doing. It seems to be all positive, but it does something that, you know, something that does play on my mind sometimes.
Mel, you were saying before that one of the goals of this whole street library movement was to build community. And I just wonder if finally what your experience of that has actually been as someone who's got a street library out the front of your place, who, you know, has eyes on the whole network across the country in many ways. How do you see this kind of sharing economy when it comes to the exchange of books like this contributing to relationships between people, perhaps even in your own neighbourhood?
I reckon it's unreal, actually. so people talk to me because of the street library. And so you know, on my street, there's people that I talk to who I would have no cause to talk to, right, any other time. And I can give you an example. So there is a lady who lives up the road from me and she would just walk past and occasionally look in the street library and, you know, we would chat. She had dogs and whenever I saw her, I started talking to her. I didn't know her name. But then I found out her name and she sort of stopped coming by and I felt some concern and I put a note under her door. And then I received a phone call from her sister, actually, who let me know that this lady had been admitted into hospital because she had collapsed on the floor of her home. And, you know, it's not like I was ever going to find her or save her, but it was lovely to... be there when she came home and, you know, just walk her dogs and things like that. And I don't think that, I can honestly say, I don't think that connection would have been made, you know, without having some reason to talk in the street. And then, you know, at work as well, people come in or walk past or see me just walk out of the shop and they stop me and they say, oh, thanks, you know, this is such a great initiative. And I'm very quickly point out that, you know, it wasn't my idea and I'm not the founder, but yes, it's a lovely project. And I just think it's something that really... makes people smile and gives them cause to comment in a nice way. And today there seems to be so many cranky people, so it's so nice to just hear from someone who's genuinely grateful and happy about this tiny, you know, little community initiative. It's really lovely.
Mel Lake, the General Manager of Street Libraries Australia, a not-for-profit network of at least 6,000 registered street libraries across the country. Earlier on Soul Search, you heard from Lismore's Joan Nemeth. She lives without earning or spending or even using money. If you're curious about this and you'd like to hear more about how buying less stuff might just lead to a richer life, you can also catch up on last week's episode with the Soul Search podcast. You'll meet two different people and hear their experience of living a full life with less. For now, thanks to producers Hong Jiang, Rowan Salmond and Nadia El-Ghouli. I'm Meredith Flake. Thanks so much for your company and I'll catch you again for Soul Search by podcast on Radio Australia and on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.